Welcome to the Superconscious Success Podcast, where Jen and her Superconscious Success Family co-hosts bring you valuable content each and every week on topics relating to manifestation, spirituality, and most of all, using your superconscious to manifest success in all areas of your life. Now on to today's episode.
Hey there, Superconscious Success fam. Welcome back to another chapter reading. We are going to continue our Napoleon Hill book, Grow Rich with Peace of Mind. And this chapter is about one of my most favorite topics, being the ego. But this chapter is actually about how to develop your own healthy ego. Because if you allow your ego to take over and to take control, it loses that connection with your higher self. And therefore, you find it difficult to actually hear what your higher self is trying to tell you. So it's really important that we learn to develop a healthy ego. And so we're going to get started reading because Napoleon Hill knew exactly what he was talking about. And so let's get started. All your ability and personality show themselves in your ego. For many a man, the ego works always at full power, and for some it needs restraining. For most, it is well to find and use some ego-boosting device. Your own ego booster may be connected with the way you dress, the way you express yourself, your surroundings, some object which has symbolic value, or in some other way which has a special individual meaning. The ego can be attuned to mysterious forces beyond oneself. Through your ego, you can be guided towards an expression of yourself which reflects in your increased prosperity. I have spoken before and shall speak again on the need for knowing your own mind and going in your own direction. Now let us look at the ego, that invaluable mind spark plug, which my dictionary defines as a self-assertive tendency of man. People who have peace of mind also have healthy egos. Now to sum, the term healthy ego brings to mind the picture of a loud, back-slapping type of person. This may be so, but it is not necessarily so. Your ego, as you reflect it to the world, has been built for many years out of childhood influences, later influences, and a great many other factors. Your ego is as individual as your fingerprints, and what is healthy to you will not be healthy for another man. Often ego seems to have a bit of vanity in it, but it is far stronger and far more subtle than the ordinary human vanity. Think of your ego as an invisible part of yourself which makes you strong and resourceful, or puts obstacles in your way according to the sort of influence you feed it. Even the greatest of minds now and then find themselves with a rundown ego. Truly great men feel this and quickly restore their egos. The purpose of this chapter is to show you some of the surprisingly straightforward ego boosters which others have used, and to give you an assortment out of which you may choose and perfect a tailor-made ego booster of your own. The ego that was stronger than a clean shirt and a shave. It is old advice and good advice to say that being well-dressed and well-groomed gives a boost to your ego. Now I want you to meet a man who knew that very well, but whose deeply abiding ego was strong enough to rise above a clean shirt and a shave. The impact of this story will be stronger if I tell it in sequence as it came to me. It begins with my meeting Edwin C. Barnes when he was Thomas Edison's business associate. Mr. Barnes at that time owned 31 expensively tailored suits and in the course of a month never wore one suit 2 days in a row. His shirts were made to order out of the most expensive fabrics available. His ties were made to order in Paris and cost at least $25 a piece. One day I suggested jokingly to Mr. Barnes that he let me know when he was ready to discard some of his suits so that I might wear them. "I know you are kidding," Barnes said, "but you might like to know that at the time I decided to associate myself with Thomas Edison, I didn't have the railroad fare to take me to East Orange, New Jersey, where I had to go to sell him the idea. My desire to get there was greater than my fear of the humiliation I'd suffer by riding a freight train. I packed a suitcase, it didn't take long, and I travelled by boxcar. When I walked into Mr. Edison's office and said I wanted to see him, I heard a titter of laughter all over the place. Finally, his secretary consented to let me see Mr. Edison. As soon as I faced the great inventor, I started telling him how fortunate he was that I was giving him the first chance at my services. After I'd talked a while, he rose, walked all around me, looked me over with penetrating eyes, grinned and asked, 'What did you come to see me about, young man?' That's how I discovered he was hard of hearing. Now I had to explain myself all over loudly. My clothes were wrinkled and dusty, my shoes were scuffed, I had a 2-day growth of beard, and I almost lost my courage. It is to Mr. Edison's credit that he did not judge me for my appearance, but I made up my mind then and there that never again would I stand before any man without knowing that I was better dressed than he. Now you see why I have all these clothes. And as far as my giving you my discards is concerned, I doubt if you'd get from them the same ego boost they give me. He was right. I never have felt the need to bolster my ego by personal adornment, and I too am right, for ego is a strictly personal matter. During the early part of my career, I did stimulate my ego with that large estate and those elegant cars. Later, when my work became widely accepted, I became content with a much simpler style of living. Yet I do not neglect my ego, which functions through my principles of guidance. Still, just like Mr. Barnes and so many others, I see myself reflecting long ago experiences which I no longer wish to suffer. During my childhood, I lived amid poverty and illiteracy, surrounded by poverty-stricken neighbours. Now I am very sensitive to the feel of any neighbourhood in which I live, and it must be just right. I even inspect the approaches to my home to make sure they do not lead through any unpleasant areas. You may find it instructive to look back at the early influences of your own life and see how much they may have to do with your actions now. Here are some questions to get you started. Think a while after each to make sure you've found the right answer. As a child, did you have sufficient food, clothing, and shelter? If the answer is no, was it insufficient by any reasonable standard or insufficient by some neighbourhood or other standards by which you have come to judge? Did your parents or someone else who had influence in your life tend to belittle you and make you feel that your brothers and sisters or playmates were better or smarter than you? Were you called basically bad when you misbehaved, or were your actions merely labelled as unacceptable? If you were bad by definition, did you decide you were going to live up to your badness? Did you have sufficient schooling in the 3 R's so that you never had to feel inferior later about your reading, writing, and arithmetic? Are you too short, too tall, or too fat so that you feel conspicuous? Are you exceptionally ill-favoured as to appearance, or scarred or crippled? How would you describe the general atmosphere in your childhood home? Peaceful, antagonistic, clouded by worry, cheerful, carelessly happy-go-lucky? Did your parents quarrel in your presence? Were you conscious of people using you as an easy mark or a push-around? Were you fond of being the leader in games and clubs? Did you set up a symbol of success early in life, such as a big house like Mr. Jones or a job travelling to glamorous places like Mr. Brown's? Did your parents encourage you to accept responsibility, or were they over-anxious to do everything for you? Were you forced to be so much on your own that you never felt you had anyone who really cared what happened to you? Thinking about such questions will suggest many facets of your past, which show themselves in your present actions. I do not suggest you worry about your past. Remember, when we close the door on the past, we close out a great deal which otherwise might hamper us. At times, however, an understanding of past influences helps you to appreciate and enjoy your present ways of bucking up your ego. A salesman sells through his ego. While I was engaged in organising the Science of Personal Achievement, I made my living by training salesmen. More than 30,000 men and women came under my guidance while they were being trained to sell. The first thing I taught my students was that before any salesman sells anything to anyone, he must first sell it to himself. That is, he must so condition his own ego that it is in shape to strengthen his statements, and he must believe that both he and his product are good. An executive of the New York Life Insurance Company gave me an interesting case. One man had been with the company for more than 30 years and had maintained a high selling record. Suddenly, his production dropped to almost nothing. The salesman could not tell what was wrong, and neither could the company executives. They called me in to doctor the patient. I went out with this salesman to observe him in action. Soon I noticed that his basic trouble after 30 years in the field was the fear that he had grown too old for selling. He talked constantly about his age. His fear had developed into hypochondria, and he felt he must use a walking stick to help him get around. Somehow he had persuaded himself that he didn't have it any longer, and so he expected to be rebuffed. He'd allowed his ego to become so thoroughly subdued that he anticipated a no before he even heard it, and that it is the best way to make sure it is said. Back in the office, I said to this man, "I want you to go out and find one of those old-fashioned ear trumpets which once were used by the hard of hearing." He protested, "But I'm not hard of hearing." "That's right," I said, "you hear too well. You hear the no before it is said. Now I want you to simulate deafness. Place the trumpet at your ear when anyone speaks. Pretend you didn't hear him, and when he says no, go right ahead with your sales talk." We agreed that he could not sell life insurance to someone who really did not need it or want it, so nobody would be hurt. He found a monstrous old hearing trumpet and took it with him on his rounds. In his first week as a trumpet user, he procured applications from 6 out of 9 prospective buyers. The next week he came back with 8 applications out of 12 interviews, an almost unheard of record. His ego restored to the yes habit, he put away the trumpet and had no trouble thereafter. Although my own hearing is fine, I seem often to come into contact with hearing troubles. My son Blair was born without ears. How I helped nature give him sufficient hearing is another story. I'm thinking now of the time when he sent him to public school wearing his hair long to hide the absence of ears. The other children made fun of his long hair, which was damaging to his ego. We promptly had his hair cut short, but first I sold Blair the idea that his affliction would be a great benefit to him when people understood about it. And that is exactly what happened, for people now were kind to him. He soon lost all self-consciousness about being different from people who have ears. Perhaps I was inspired by Thomas A. Edison's determination to make an asset out of his deafness rather than a liability. I never saw him wear an expression of annoyance or disappointment. Rather, his expression clearly said, "My ego is under my control and it does my bidding without fear or limitation." Your ego and your opulence. As with the ear trumpet, I have on many occasions been able to prescribe exactly the right ego builder for a particular person. It requires knowing the person, of course, and when you wish to prescribe for yourself, you'll see the importance of that ancient great advice, know thyself. Now and again, a man will stop working before he should and find himself at loose ends. This was the case with a former student of mine named Ray Cunliffe. He had owned a Cadillac agency in Chicago, which he sold at a handsome profit. Since he now had plenty of liquid assets, he decided to take a year and play around and rest up, as he put it. Before the year was out, he grew restless. He looked around for a good Cadillac franchise but found none. Another 6 months passed and he began to eat deeply into his cash reserve for living expenses. About that time, he joined a class in the science of personal achievement which I was teaching in Baltimore. Ray and his wife had been accustomed to having servants in their home. Now they had had to let the servants go and do their own housework. One day while Ray was in the basement doing the family laundry, it occurred to him that he was making the very mistake I had mentioned in a recent lesson. He wasn't nourishing his ego, he was starving it, beating it down. In his excitement and anxiety, he came to me for a personal help. He told me his story, then asked, "Where do I go from here?" He had told me that for several years his wife had wanted a mink coat, which could cost some $3,000. Also, I could see that although he drove a Cadillac, it was beginning to look shabby, and so did the clothes he wore. So I said, "Ray, get out your notebook and pencil while I give you a prescription for opulence. Number one, go to the nearest Cadillac agency, trade in your present car, and buy a new car of the model you like best. Number two, go to the best fur store in town and buy your wife a fine mink coat, even if it costs more than $3,000. Number three, go to your tailor and have a complete wardrobe of suits made up. Then buy the ties and shirts and shoes you need to go with your new suits. Number four, have the mink coat done up in gift wrapping. Place the package in your new Cadillac, hire a livered chauffeur, and while you are not at home, have the chauffeur drive the car to your house and deliver it in the package to your wife. Take these 4 steps immediately. Then come back for the next prescription. That is, if you need another. This one prescription may turn the tide very quickly." When the new Cadillac and the mink coat arrived at Ray's home, his wife at first refused to accept them. The chauffeur merely handed her the car keys and walked away, leaving the car in the driveway with the coat on its seat. Ray's wife finally tried the coat. Sure enough, it was the very coat she had tried on out of curiosity and longing a few weeks earlier. Suddenly, she felt a surge of confidence and happiness. The same thing was happening to Ray. Now, what I have to tell you seemed like magic to him, and it may seem like magic to you, but it was not magic. The cook and the housemaid who formerly worked for the Cunliffe showed up and asked if they might return to their old jobs. Without the slightest hesitation, Mrs. Cunliffe told them to come right in. As for Ray himself, a friend phoned him and said, "I hear that the Baltimore Cadillac agency can be bought. You might look it over." Ray looked it over and saw it was good. The deal required $150,000, however, which was quite a sum for him to raise on short notice. His ego had lifted himself out of the doldrums. He said, "I don't know who is going to let me have the money, but I know that I shall get it." The following day, he called on a man he had been avoiding, a wealthy man toward whom he had begun to feel inferior. No inferiority marred his approach now as he explained he needed $150,000 to put himself back in business. "Fine," was the answer. "I'm glad to see you getting back into the business where you always made money." He wrote Ray a check for $150,000 and added, "You can pay this back year by year as your profits come in." So Ray Cunliffe was back in a Cadillac agency of his own and doing a good business almost before he had time to wear all his new shirts. He had only one disappointment. He was disappointed that I did not show surprise over his sudden turn of fortune. "Well, Ray," I said, "I can't get excited over something I've seen happen hundreds of times." But I was pleased, of course, to see once more that poverty consciousness can be replaced by success consciousness, which invariably draws success as though with an all-powerful magnet. Ego is the key to this, an ego filled with self-confident faith and bolstered by the means that is right for you. You can paint an ego picture of yourself and use it for first aid. Sometimes a man faces a single situation on which a great deal depends. Often such a situation involves another person who must in some way be persuaded, for whom some situation must be attractive. When you know that other person, often you can use the power of your ego to give him the picture he wants to see. Even when you do not know him personally, you often can look closely at the values of the situation and come up with a picture that is attractive to him. Let us now look at myself at a stage in my career where my ego faltered. I have told how I was associated with Don Mallett, the newspaper publisher, and how his murder forced the postponement of publication of my first manuscripts, also how it saved me from wearing a big business label. As I related, I had to get out of town to hide from the thugs who believed I'd been involved in the attacks upon their illegal rum running. In the time I spent hiding, my spirits were not good. I came close to losing my faith in my ability to carry out the great task Andrew Carnegie had assigned me some 20 years before. I took hold of myself and decided to break the bondage of fear. I'd find a new publisher. Since Judge Gary had died, I had to start from scratch. Not an easy task for the unknown author of a trailblazing work. As my ego rebuilt itself and my success consciousness reasserted itself, an insistent inner voice began to tell me that I'd find my publisher in Philadelphia. I knew no publisher in that city, but the inner voice became so strong that on a capital of $50, I got into my car and headed towards the Quaker City, half believing I'd find the solution to my problem, half believing I was going mad. Once in Philadelphia, I began to look through a classified telephone directory. I hoped to find a cheap boarding house where I could stay for a couple of dollars a day. Now, following closely what happened, for this story is one of the most startling you ever may read, and it contains, besides its revelation of the power of ego, a revelation of the supreme secret that can transform your life. As I turned the pages of the directory, that inner voice spoke again. It said, "Never mind looking for a cheap boarding house. Go to the best hotel in the city and register for the best suite of rooms in the house." I closed the book and blinked my eyes. I had less than $35 in my pocket. But the command was so irresistible that I picked up my luggage, marched to the best hotel in town and took a suite which cost $25 a day. The moment I signed the register, I knew I had done the right thing. My ego and my faith swelled within me. I could not then have put my supreme secrets into words, but I know it took hold of me. A quarter was a good tip for a bellhop in those days, but I tossed the boy a dollar. No sooner had I seated myself in one of the luxurious chairs than the inner voice spoke once more. "You were restrained from registering in a cheap rooming house because such an environment would have placed you at a great disadvantage in dealing with a publisher. Right now you need an ego booster and you are getting it from this finely appointed suite of rooms. Now your mind can conceive on a positive plane that brings success. Ready? Call into your consciousness the name of every person you know who has the financial means to publish your works. When the right name appears, you'll recognize it. Get in touch with that person and tell him what you desire." Without a shred of doubt, in perfect faith, I began to review the names of men who would be able to finance the world's first practical signs of personal achievement. After 3 hours of this, my mind went blank. Then a name popped into my mind with such compelling effect that I knew this was the man I wanted. He was Albert Lewis Pelton of Meriden, Connecticut. All I knew about Mr. Pelton was that he had published a book called Power of Will and that he had advertised this book in My Golden Rule magazine several years previously. Immediately, I wrote to Mr. Pelton by special delivery. I informed him that I was about to confer upon him the honour of publishing the Signs of Personal Achievement. 2 days later, I received a telegram saying Mr. Pelton was on his way to Philadelphia to see me. I shall never forget the expression on his face when he was ushered into my suite, nor the words he uttered. Well, an author who can live in a suite of rooms like this must be the real McCoy. The manuscript was about the size of an old-fashioned family Bible. It contained 1,800 pages and weighed about 7 pounds. I handed it to Mr. Pelton and he sat down and turned through the pages. After about 20 minutes, he closed the book and laid it on the table. He said, I'll publish this philosophy and pay you the regular author's royalty. We sent for a typewriter and he typed the contract. At one point he said, I suppose you'd like an advance on your royalties. I'll make out a check right now. I replied nonchalantly, holding fast to the image my ego had built. Oh, make it any amount you care to. $500? Okay. Some months later, the first published set of my work, The Law of Success, in 8 volumes, was presented to me. Those had been successful months in many ways, for I had regained the power of a positive point of view. I hope sincerely that those who read this story will not have to win their own positive points of view the long way around as I did. Had I been guided by some unseen power, I believe some outside force was guiding me. I believe that a mind attuned to currents of faith is attuned because its own physical dimension. Later in this book, I shall relate another experience of the sort, actually the experience which resulted in my writing this book after nearly 70 years of getting ready. Since that eventful day in 1928, I've helped tens of thousands of men and women to rehabilitate their egos. Most of them I've never met, for our minds contacted each other through the pages of my books. Through my lectures and personal lessons, I also have helped many thousands to find the same key to the conceptual and achieving powers of the mind. And here in many cases, I had the gratification of seeing it happen. I've developed a considerable ability to gauge people's needs in this direction and to press the right button, so to speak. But what takes place when the button is pressed? Whence comes the power that revitalizing a faltering ego? What is it that turns a mind from no to yes and so opens great gates of achievement? I still am seeking that answer. Perhaps the knowledge that has been reserved for me to uncover as a sort of postgraduate course in my own work, for I never shall be finished with this learning. Look for your own ego booster and you'll find it. There are amazing varieties of ways to boost the ego. Although they may be mysterious in their inmost essence, their outward manifestations are clear to see. Consider the following examples. They are universal in their application and may help you to find your own. Among the successful insurance men I've trained is one among many who drives an expensive car. His ego booster is more individual. It consists of a handsome golf bag and a set of clubs he carries in full view in the car. He thus carries with him the impression, both for himself and for others, that he spends considerable time playing golf and is always ready to drive to the links. I do not know if he would be as successful as he is if he did not always display this intimation of success. But I do know that he gets exactly what he needs as an ego booster. Another successful insurance agent I trained wears an 8-carat diamond ring, which seems to serve as his magic wand as he talks to prospects. This man is one of the largest producers for the Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company. Once he took his diamond ring to a jeweler for a new mounting. The job required a few days. During those days, he worked harder than usual, used every persuasive argument he always had used in order to write a policy, and yet failed to make a sale. He said that when he began to talk to a prospect, he'd look down for his ring. The ring was not there, and somehow he could not put himself over. When the ring was back on his finger, this man went to work as usual. And out of his first 6 interviews, he received 6 applications for insurance, a record he never had made before. As for myself, if I were caught in public with such a searchlight on my finger, I would feel so self-conscious that I would get in my own way and be unable to command my ego. To each his own, and a mighty power comes to the man who knows himself. When a man comes to himself, discovers his ego and takes possession of it, the fact is revealed to the whole world. It is reflected in the tone of his voice, in his facial expression, in the lift of his emotions, in the clarity of his thought, in the definiteness of his purpose, in a positive mental attitude that brings out in others the desire to believe in and work with this man. Friend, when you become commander-in-chief of that very core of your mind, your ego, you are a master of all your survey. You never will want because you will unhesitatingly find the way to plenty. You never will fear because your mind will not contain fear. You'll be free, gloriously free, living a life that pays you in your own terms. Some few there are who needs rein upon their egos. They are so rare, however, that we need not write any part of this book for them. A healthy ego is a means of health and peace of mind beyond comparison. Look then for the one right method or object or condition which helps you to fulfill yourself in the self-assertive tendency of man. Study the ways of any successful, happy people you know. Chances are that they possess and use the supreme secret. So there we go. That is a really interesting chapter where we actually talked about creating a healthy ego, because we all have egos, and it's just a matter of being able to manage it successfully so that we can start to manifest that which we desire. Now, as with every other chapter, head across to superconsciousSuccess.com, sign up for the Inner Circle. You can get the summaries and the extra little tidbits that was actually created and written in this book. And until next chapter, I look forward to bringing it to you. Thanks a lot. Catch you later. Bye.